hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. And they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. This is Paul Frog, and you're on the fighting side of me.
We've got
a TV program that's recorded in Canada and is, I believe, distributed elsewhere. And I've actually seen a couple of episodes lately, and I saw it on TV last night, and. It's called, what's it called here? Don't need to be quite so disorganized. It's called, it was actually on Spark TV channel, and it's called Shade. Now, Shade, as far as I can understand it, is a female detective, and she has a white sidekick who is really quite sharp. She's quite bossy, but he's quite helpful to her. Anyway, they were solving some sort of a crime, which is actually not neither here nor there. But an enemy of hers is a Negro detective, and he's all, you know, like many of these crime shows, because she's an amateur detective. The professionals are always down on her case, wanted to butt out of these cases and so on. And this is a Negro detective, of course, and apparently they had an affair or a relationship. That is the white detective. Well, she's kind of brownish looking, I would say. Well, I mean, tan looking, I'd say. She's perhaps is an Italian actress, Italian or Armenian. But anyway, she's on a good day, white. But of course, one of the reasons the Negro detective seems to be on her case is that they had a relationship, and in a previous episode, he'd even invited her to go down for. He said she seems rather stressed. Why don't we go down to, I think it was Aruba in the Caribbean for a week's vacation together? And I thought, you know, this is absolutely gratuitous, apropos of utterly nothing. This endless push at normalizing race mixing. Of course, race mixing occurs. We know that. But this is normalizing it. And this is part of the endless propaganda push that we see in the media and education and advertising to try to normalize the abnormal, in this case, interracial marriage, or I should say interracial sex. As I mentioned yesterday at some length, in the education system, the celebration of the normalcy of freakery, of the LGBTQ, transgenderism, choose your own sex, and all that, and everything's okay. Well, everything's not okay. But this is a way of normalizing and confusing people. Well, here's a cartoon that was sent my way. And here is, I guess, a progressive North American, a little stick figure in a dress or something, and it's the rainbow colors, okay, that. And he's, she, it, I guess, it's non-gendered, is looking at stick figures. They're all dusky, female with, a kneecap on, that's a, you know, head-to-foot bag, except for a slit for her eyes. She's carrying a sign that says Sharia, and another one of them is carrying an ISIS flag, and they all, of course, have cell phones. And the North American stick figure says, look at these poor refugees. Why won't you accept them, you monsters? Now, then in the next frame, there are white South Africans. A family of white South Africans and a woman from the Ukraine. And the same stick figure is now proclaiming, refugees, I can smell their white privilege a mile away. And the comment or caption, it says, white South Africans are being raped, tortured, and murdered. Ukrainian war children are made orphans. No one wants them because diversity is about getting rid of whites. Now that is the bottom line. When you hear diversity, it means they don't want you. Diversity is a code word for white genocide. Now that may sound a little bit harsh or broad in its implications or sweeping, but it's not. That is the meaning of diversity. And you know, when you hear all the organizations in our society today that pledge themselves to diversity. In fact, in the mission statement of ever so many institutions, you will see them proclaiming their commitment to diversity. We are building a diverse workforce, a diverse this, diverse that. I mean, what it means is they don't want people like you. That's what it means. They don't want people like you. You're on your way out, and they can't get rid of you fast enough. And no, they don't particularly want your sons and daughters either, if they're white. Diversity is a code word for white genocide, or if that seems just a little too, well, it sounds a bit extreme to me, what about white replacement? That's being promoted by many of the institutions in our society. Many of the institutions which are led by people who are at least nominally white. This is the big betrayal. Now, we had a civil service servant up here in Canada who is the head of the Privy Council. Whenever I hear that word, I'm inclined to snicker because a privy is an old-fashioned word for an outdoor washroom. But anyway, okay, the Privy Council actually means is an even older meaning of the word privy, meaning private. The Privy Council is the office of the Prime Minister, and it's become increasingly powerful in Canada over the past 3 or 4 decades. Now, the clerk of the Privy Council is the chief civil servant. He's also the secretary to the cabinet. He's very, very powerful, very important. Well, the clerk of the Privy Council, Michael Wernick, was testifying to the Commons Justice Committee a little over a week ago, and he was testifying about the scandal of undue interference on the part of operatives of the Liberal government, including himself, in a decision as to whether to grant a sweetheart deal to a big, powerful, and relatively corrupt Quebec company named SNC-Lavalin. It's an engineering company with contracts all over the world, and so on. Anyway, the ins and outs of the incident are really not all that important. But at that time, the clerk warned darkly he says he's never been so worried about Canada, about the disrespect for the honorable men and women in the civil service and in the government who have only their country's best interests at heart, and the use of the words like traitor and treason, and what he called the vomitorium of the social media. He didn't give specifics. He didn't say who it was he was referring. But I can tell you who it was. The Yellow Vest movement were part of a protest the week before in Ottawa, and it was a protest primarily about this the energy industry policies of the federal government, and of course the carbon tax, and also. Many of the Yellow Vests were very concerned, and rightly so, about immigration and about Canada signing on to a UN statement of principles about refugees, which committed us to supporting refugees, sheltering them, helping bring their family, the whole nine yards. And also, very in a very sinister manner, suppressing media outlets and others who are guilty of xenophobia. You know what that is, of course. That's fear of the strangers or criticism of immigration. Now, what sort of democratic government would sign on to something like that? Well, the United States government didn't. Austria didn't. Hungary didn't, Australia didn't, but good old goody two-shoes Canada did. Now, some of the signs carried by some of the members of the Yellow Vest movement talked about treason. Well, when you sell out your own people, can you think of another word for it? A nicer word? Well, maybe there are nicer ones, I don't know. But is it inaccurate? I mean, that's the only thing I care about. Is it inaccurate? If it is, okay, it should not be used. But it is accurate. What do you call the betrayal of your own people? What would you call signing up with a treaty that commits the government to betray it, to suppressing freedom of speech for its own people? Now, the supporters of that, of course, will say, well, it's non-binding. Okay, so you sign a non-binding treaty that commits you to silencing your own people. Okay, you're not bound by
by law. The UN won't invade us if we don't do it. but what sort of person would sign such a thing and still get offended at the term traitor? I think it's the absolute height of hypocrisy. And I feel that the powers that be are getting just a little bit scared as more and more people become woke or politically aware and start speaking out. And I think of that reaction every time since that I've heard the term diversity. Diversity really is a code word for getting rid of you and me. Diversity is a code word for white replacement and white genocide. So when institutions that we might support or I should say be part of tell us that they're for diversity, that's one of our, I hate that term, core values. Diversity, that means you're not for me. And you know, I think more and more we as whites have to challenge that and question that and say, what do you mean? You're for diversity. What do you have against me? You've got to make it personal. We've become such a wimpified nation that a line of argument a lot of people, instead of arguing against an issue or a policy, will say, well, it makes me feel scared. It makes me, I feel unsafe. I feel threatened. And I think often we are perhaps too irrational. I mean, it's too rational. Not the rationality is not a good thing. It sure is. But I think we should throw it back at them. What do you have against me? You make it personal. Here's a commentary on Facebook by a woman named Karen Baker. And there's kind of a lot in this little comment. She says, Hitler created a new monetary system for the Germans called the Labor Treasury Note. He had outlawed usury by punishment of death and created a new Deutschmark that was backed only by productive German physical and intellectual labor. His method cut out the cancerous international banking cabal and was also the blueprint for shattering the New World Order. The Rothschild cabal was about to... the Rothschild cabal was about to be out on their asses in more countries than just Germany. They had to burn Germany from end to end to stop this financial revolution from taking root on an international scale. Because the world was watching the German economy as it took off like a rocket after the parasitic banksters were deleted from the equation. In fact, the Holocaust story exists really to distract people from Germany's economic miracle. Now, I've argued that for a long time. That's not the only reason for the Holocaust story, but it's certainly one. And then here's my argument. Hitler turned Germany around in 2 years. He came to power in January 1933. By 1935, he had virtually full employment. While much of the rest of the West, Canada, the United States, the United Kingdom, was mired in the Great Depression, and nothing really seemed to work. The generation that came of age, say, hit 18 in 1929, many of them would not actually have a permanent, a full-time job until the war came. Well, 1939 for Canada, 1941 for the United States. And then somehow magically, where there was no money before, to for businesses and so on, there just wasn't the money.
suddenly we had enough money to launch a war, to build all sorts of airplanes and battleships and tanks and cannons and so on and so on. That's perhaps another story. But the powers that be, whether it was the New Deal in the United States or various things that were tried in Canada, nothing actually seemed to work to repair the economy. Well, what did Hitler do? You've almost never hear anybody able to answer that. But his economic achievements were absolutely undeniable, and they were the talk of the civilized world. Our own prime minister at the time, William Lyon Mackenzie King, said something roughly to the effect, "We must study more carefully what Mr. Hitler is doing in Germany with his economy. It certainly is working." He was mystified. He didn't know, what is this guy doing that's put the people back to work? Workers had better wages. They had guaranteed holidays. There were even workers' retreats in the mountains and on the sea. Conditions were vastly improved. The autobahns enviable highway system that was being built. So what did he do? Well, Karen Baker explains it in a way I'll explain just a little differently. Not everybody would agree with me on this, but Hitler implemented a form of what is called social credit. Now, what social credit does, and yes, it does very neatly do an end run around the banksters. And what it does is this. Always trying to explain economic things is sometimes a bit complicated, but let me go at it this way. When you put $100 in the bank, you may think, well, the bank takes my $100 and lends it out to somebody else. They pay me a very small amount of interest, and then they charge much higher interest to the person to whom they lend the money, and it's the spread covers their expenses and their profit, right? Well, that makes some sense. That would be what would happen if you put your money in a credit union. But no, what the bank does is this, through the magic of fractional reserve. This is how it goes. The bank takes your $100 and lends out a multiple of that. The multiple is about 26. So it lends out $2,600 on the power of your $100. $100. Now, it's created this credit out of nothing, out of thin air. But it lends that out to, let's say, 26 people. Each borrows $100, and they owe interest on that. Now, that is a problematic system for many reasons that I won't go into, but it all comes down to being able to create this credit out of thin air. Now, what social credit says is the creation of credit should also benefit society as a whole. This power to create buying power out of nothing. And so social credit says that whatever is physically and humanly possible should be made economically possible. See, under the old model during the Depression, yes, it would have been wonderful to build a network of roads. And yes, it would have been wonderful to build hospitals and better schools and so on and so on. But couldn't be done because there was no money. Or, I'm sorry, there wasn't enough money. For the banks to create the money, to lend the money to the government, would have meant a huge increase in taxes. Similarly to businesses. So what social credit says is, if it's physically and humanly possible, it should be made economically possible.
So, to make it simple, in Germany in the 1930s, it was physically possible to build this network of roads, right? They had the engineering, they had the raw materials, okay? Was it humanly possible? Yes, they had willing and capable labor, they had the engineers to design the roads, so it was humanly and physically possible. It was made economically possible by creating the credit, which was guaranteed not by gold or something else, but by the talents of the German working people and the physical resources of the country. So Hitler printed money, brought money into creation in order to pay for the raw materials and pay the workers, and the roads got built without inflation, incidentally. That's what social credit is. That was what Hitler did. Some of the more involved economic aficionados might disagree with me a little bit around the edges on this, and I don't want to delve into that too much. But the bottom line was that system worked. The social credit allowed Hitler to revive, rebuild the German economy, and rebuild it without debt. Just absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. And that is one of the reasons why Hitler, at least in politically correct circles today, can only ever be mentioned essentially like a spit or a curse. Hitler, the Holocaust of the Jews, Hitler, the worst man in human history, the monster, and so on. And never neutrally, never, well, this is what this man did, whether good or bad, this is how he got his country back to work. No, they don't, they're powerful forces that don't want you to know about that. And if you do know about it, not to think about it. Like, you're almost supposed to be like the, you may remember from being in grade school, sometimes very immature, four or five or six-year-olds, when you're trying to tell them something, will plug their ears and just make silly noises. And that's the way so much of our politically correct establishment, the banksters and others, are. They don't want you to know the miracle. No, it wasn't just that Hitler created the miracle that could be created here. For instance, and this may be this may be controversial, but we could have America could have universal Medicare if it adopted a social credit system. There certainly is the talent. They've got the medical, the trained medical people, and so on. There's certainly, in most cases, there's certainly the material necessary to build more hospitals or to build more clinics to produce the sophisticated diagnostic equipment, etc. Often it's just, well, there just isn't the money. There could be, though. But there are powerful forces that don't want you to know that. And that's why the endless, ongoing defamation of Adolf Hitler. You would think he was alive and well and somewhere in the mountains of Germany today. The vehemence of the anti-Nazi propaganda. You'd think we were still at in an actual shooting war. It's not the man Adolf Hitler anymore. It's the ideas that they want deep-sixed and suppressed. I was talking to somebody yesterday. We were talking about some of the put in quotation marks, monsters of the 20th century. One of them, of course, was Joseph Stalin, a mass murderer, probably responsible for, well, Jewish created communism, has on its bill of indictment the deaths of over 100 million Christian, mostly Christians in Europe. But anyways, one of the great murdering monsters is Joseph Stalin. In China, Mao Zedong, Mao responsible for the murder of probably 66 or more million, 66 million of his own people. Pol Pot, that's P-O-L, not P-A-U-L, Pol Pot, the maniac dictator of Cambodia, or Kampuchea as it was then, it would be called, exterminated a third, about 2 million people of his population, out of about 6 million Cambodians, about a third were exterminated in a over a decade. Okay, these were great monsters. And then, now I don't consider Adolf Hitler a monster. I think he was probably one of the greatest men of the 20th century. But he's alleged to have been responsible for the murder of 6 million Jews. Now, that's a different matter. But okay. Well, what in terms of public knowledge today, most people, unless you're, say, of my generation, might have problems even knowing who Stalin was. And certainly if you knew vaguely he was the communist leader of Russia, you know, from roughly 1924 through to about 1956, that's about all you'd know. He wouldn't be a particular monster. Pol Pot, again, a good many people wouldn't even know who he was. If they did, well, he was some guy in Cambodia. And similarly, Mao Zedong. There was a time when I was in my 20s, we had a very active Maoist movement, not only in Canada, but in Europe. The French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who made quite a reputation for himself as a left-wing intellectual, a proponent of a particular brand of philosophy, was a committed Maoist. You know, that was far more radical than Soviet communism. It was like the real deal, real collectivization. I mean, there was collectivization in Russia, but this is the real deal. You had French intellectuals like him avidly following Mao Zedong, the mass murderer. People would actually have his Mao's little red book of sayings and would quote from it. You get a few people, leftist trendies in North America, but in Red China, you would be ostracized or worse if you didn't have your little red book and weren't prepared to, as a pompous little fool, to whip it out and start quoting Mao Zedong thought. In fact, in the ramblings of the Canadian Communist Party of Canada, Marxist-Leninists, which were the Maoists, that they would talk about their commitment to Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought. Okay, if you went to college in the last 20 years, what do you know about Mao Zedong? Probably not much. Is anybody running around today earnestly quoting the little red book? No, probably not even in China. Well, whatever happened to these monsters, Mao Zedong and Pol Pot and Joseph Stalin? Well, they're largely forgotten. Their mass crimes, largely forgotten. And if you were to announce to somebody, well, you know, I have studied Stalin, and I'm a bit of a Stalinist. A lot of people would probably look at you and say, well okay, you're a Stalinist. What does that mean? If you said, I've studied the writings and the actions of Adolf Hitler, and I'm actually a National Socialist, or you wouldn't, if you knew anything, say, I'm actually a Nazi. because that's like saying I'm a bum, I'm an idiot. But no, if you said, no, I'm a follower of Adolf Hitler.
Now, of course, you would be widely, rabidly condemned like a mad dog. Why? Because he murdered 6 million Jews, you'll be told. You're a follower of a man like that. You're And it surprises me doesn't surprise me that he has been so demonized, because he stood for something that actually did his country immense good. So he has to be defamed as like the devil, smeared and labeled, and the big label, of course, put on him was he was responsible for the death of 6 million Jews. That's all you're supposed to think about. Oh, okay, I turn my hearing aid off after that. Hitler bad, and you're not allowed to. In fact, they don't want you to look more closely as to, well, what exactly did this man do? Whereas people like Stalin, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, who did monstrous things, far more than the alleged 6 million that Hitler killed, are largely forgotten and certainly not remembered, except in certain quarters like us who were anti-communists, as the monsters they were. And when I see this wildly over-the-top anti-Nazi propaganda, especially when taken in context, in comparison to the real deeds of others of the 20th century, who even if you accept 6 million, did far, far worse things than Adolf Hitler, it was alleged to have done, then, you can see there's a special agenda going on here. And, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Somebody whose writings I quite like is Paul Craig Roberts. Paul Craig Roberts was a official in the Reagan administration, and here is a recent article of his that I think is a little depressing, but quite good. This is, Americans are so feeble-minded today, they brainwash easily, by Paul Craig Roberts. He asks the question, how can a propagandized people ultimately be free? If you're that, feeble-minded. And this is actually from Russia Today. Majority of Americans now consider Russia a critical threat. Russia's already negative image among Americans only worsened over the past year, with a majority for the first time saying Russia's military power poses a threat to the U.S. vital interests, and a third identifying Russia as the United States' chief enemy. It's so daft. The ones trying to steal American technological secrets and challenging America in the Pacific. And in the economy, it's Red China. Meanwhile, the percentage of Americans viewing Russia unfavorably edged up a point to 73%. Each of these negative perceptions of Russia marks a record high in Gallup trends. The February 1st to 10th poll of this year coincided with the Trump administration's February 1st announcement that the U.S. is pulling out of the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty, the INF treaty, over concerns Russia hasn't complied with arms control agreement. In the survey, 52% of Americans rated the military power of Russia as a critical threat to U.S. vital interests. This is up from 39% 3 years ago, and from just 18% in 2004. Although sizable segments of Republicans and Democrats view Russia's military as a critical threat, the figure is higher among Democrats, 65%, than Republicans, only 46%.
Russia displaces North Korea as the U.S. arch rival. And I think both views are wrong. Russia's not the arch rival of the U.S., nor is North Korea. North Korea is an enemy. It's a danger, but it's not the arch rival. It's in no position to conquer very much in Asia. Red China is. Americans are now more likely to name Russia than any other country as the nation they think is the United States' greatest enemy. Russia has displaced North Korea in the top spot, as mentions of Russia swelled from 19% in 2018 to 32% today. Meanwhile, mentions of North Korea plummeted from 51% to 14% following last year's dialogue between the two countries when Donald Trump met President Kim Jong-un of North Korea in Singapore. Here was the question. What one country anywhere in the world do you consider to be the United States' greatest enemy today? In 2018, 19% said Russia. This year, 32% said Russia. In 2018, 11% said Red China. 21% said Russia. This would be the greatest enemy. Americans really missed the point about Red China. Greatest enemy, 51% in 2018 said North Korea. Well, they were wrong. 14% said this year. Afghanistan, 2% thought that was the biggest enemy this year. Mexico, 1%, Iraq, 2%. And, you know, you wonder that with the greatest enemy, I mean, Iraq, I mean, granted, only 1% thought it was the greatest enemy, but you just wonder, where are people's brains? China is also more likely to be seen as a top adversary this year, with 21% citing it versus just 11% a year ago. Gallup has asked Americans to name the country they consider to be the United States' greatest enemy 12 times since 2001. Russia ranked first in 2015, but with only 18% mentioning it. Besides North Korea, other countries cycling through the top spot, including Iraq, Iran, and China. And you know, I think Paul Craig Roberts is absolutely right that this is very depressing. Americans have been so misled and so misguided on this. Well, this is Paul Frauen. You're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical interlude right now and I'm going to play a country western singer. I really like her, and so did the late George Jones. He was very, very complimentary about this lady from California. She's kind of a Bakersfield sound country and western singer. Heather Miles, and this is an old Ray Price song, Crazy Arms. Troubled mind, no sooner to another. and the Miles, and the old Ray Price song, Crazy Arms. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Here's a man named Whispering Bill Anderson. He's an absolute stalwart of the Grand Ole Opry for so many decades. This is a really a song that really tugs, on the heartstrings, and it's I Wonder If God Likes Country Music. This is Whispering Bill Anderson.
Talked a lot today about our friends at the Grand Ole Opry as we salute the Grand Ole Opry on Country's Family Reunion. I don't think anybody has mentioned the name of Roy Acuff, but I want to do that because some of my greatest memories of being on the Opry were the nights that Mr. Roy would come out on the stage and allow me to share the spotlight with him and do this song right here. I got a lot of wonderful memories. If we have time, I'll share some of you, but first, I'd like to do the song, and I hope you'll enjoy it. I hope maybe you remember. One night, we were out on tour getting ready to do a show. And at the time, it really wasn't anything all that special. It was what you might call just another one-night stand. When I looked over my guitar, and there stood an old man. His cowboy clothes were frayed and worn, and his roots were far from new. He said, I'd like to sit in with your band. He said, I'm a country singer too. Yeah, well, we just all had a big laugh. When I looked back at the old man, there was a tear in his eye. So I told the band to coo, because I didn't want to see him cry. He reached down and he took my guitar. And with a determined look on his face. But then as he started to play and sing, a look of sadness took its place. He said, I've sang my songs from Maine to California. Sing the world through the window of a car. I never made a dime back when I made it, never saved a dime.
Still hear his words today.
Wow, isn't that an emotional song? Whispering Bill Anderson and I wonder if God likes country music. Well, I'm sure he does. This is Paul Frommer. You're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Let's play this song here by Amber Digby with Vince Gill, The One I Can't Live Without. This is Paul Frommer, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me.
Just ain't right. It's true, she's there waiting and wondering if there's no doubt.
But she's the one you live with,
and you're the one I can't live without.
She's the one you live with,
you're the one I can't live without.
That's Amber Digby in a duet with Vince Gill. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time, and I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the Fighting Side of Me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.